This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Independent Living, bringing you thought-provoking news from a wide variety of medical newsletters and journals to help you in your quest to lead a healthy, happy, and productive life for years to come. It's all in Independent Living, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Independent Living, and I'm your reader, Leslie, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from several health newsletters. The first one is from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. That is copyright 2025, Mayo Foundation for Medical Research, Education and Research. And this first article is Mohs Surgery. That's spelled M-O-H-S, Mohs Surgery. Skin cancer's worst foe. When it comes to skin cancer, a healthcare team's first thought is to remove the cancer and limit or eliminate its chances of regrowth. But with cancers found on the head and neck, appearance matters too. These areas tend to be more visible, and the skin can be more sensitive due to not having the same depth as in other parts of the body. Mohs surgery aims to address this dilemma. In this type of surgery, just enough skin is cut away so that all cancerous tissue is removed and no more. Mohs surgery removes skin in and around the growth, with each layer examined for the presence of cancer cells while the patient waits. If cancer cells are present, another small amount of skin is removed. Skin removal stops when cancer no longer is detected. The precision of skin removal and near certainty that all cancer cells have been removed make Mohs surgery the go-to procedure for many types of skin cancer occurring in areas where skin preservation is a must. For decades, doctors relied on a traditional method to remove skin cancers. This involves cutting away suspicious skin areas with a wide margin of tissue that's likely to be healthy and free of cancer cells. This method works well in large areas of the body, such as the trunk, arms, and legs, where there's ample tissue and scarring is less of a concern. It's also often necessary and works well with deadly cancers, especially melanoma. Mohs surgery, named for the doctor who developed it, has been around since the 1930s, but didn't gain wider acceptance until the 1970s and 80s. Today, Mohs is the gold standard procedure for treating many types of skin cancer that occur, or recur, on the face, head, neck, hands, feet, and genitals. This matters especially because about 80% of some skin cancer types occur above the shoulders. When it's used, Mohs surgery has the lowest recurrence rates of any skin cancer removal process. It's primarily used for the two most common types of skin cancer, basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. The basal cell carcinoma, Mohs surgery results in a cure rate of 99% at 5 years for a first-time cancer and of 96 to 98% for a recurrent cancer. And for the squamous cell carcinoma, Mohs surgery results in a cure rate of better than 97% at 5 years for a first-time cancer and of about 94% for a recurrent cancer. Melanoma skin cancers aren't as common as these other types, but they are particularly deadly. Mohs surgery is not recommended for the primary treatment of invasive melanomas when the clear margins can be obtained. Margins include the visible boundary of the cancerous area, plus an additional area of non-cancerous skin around it. However, the surgery sometimes is used for shallow melanomas in complex, delicate areas, such as around the eyes, lips, or nose. So here's what to expect. Mohs is an outpatient procedure that requires only local anesthetic and sometimes a relaxing medication. Most of the time, the procedure takes less than 4 hours. The area of skin to be operated on is cleaned and then outlined with a special pen. After the anesthetic takes effect, the surgeon uses a scalpel to remove the visible portion of the cancer. The surgeon also takes a thin layer of tissue underneath and around the cancer as healthy skin margins. A temporary bandage is placed where the skin was removed. The tissue is then analyzed under a microscope. This part of the procedure usually takes the longest time. If cancer is found in a certain place in the tissue sample, the surgeon knows precisely where to remove additional layers of tissue until the last tissue sample removed is cancer-free. At the outset of surgery, it's impossible to predict exactly how far the cancer has spread. For most people, the surgery is a very smooth process, with the cancer removed and the wound repaired in a half day. Often, scars heal in a way that's barely noticeable. But some cancers are more widespread. They require a longer surgery, and skin repair may become more complex, such as involving a skin graft. Mohs surgery is usually a very safe procedure, with complications occurring 2% or less of the time. Bleeding, infection, and numbness in the area of the procedure are among the most common, but still are rare complications. Recovery considerations. Most wounds are repaired at the end of Mohs surgery. You may have some mild pain and soreness afterwards. Non-prescription pain medications may help. Severe pain after surgery is not common and should be reported to your care team. Your care team can give you instructions on how to take care of the wound. You can expect to wear a bandage over the wound for at least a week, though exactly how long you'll need a bandage depends on your situation. You may be asked to change the bandage every day. Though Mohs surgery has a high rate of cure for skin cancer, there's still a small risk of cancer recurrence. In addition, those who develop basal or squamous cell carcinoma frequently develop another skin cancer within 5 years. Be sure to talk with your healthcare team about a plan for regular follow-up skin exams to catch any future cancers as early as possible and about ways to reduce your risk of those cancers. This next article is titled Ductal Carcinoma in Situ. And so this is a different type of cancer, but here are the treatments. Treatment shifts for this early form of breast cancer. When breast cancer is diagnosed, it's natural for thoughts to go straight to treatment. But for some early cancers, is prompt treatment or sometimes any treatment at all the only path worth considering? That's a question medical experts are exploring with ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS. This very early form of breast cancer makes up around 25% of breast cancer diagnoses. DCIS is cancer cells that are found in a duct in the breast that haven't moved outside of the duct to surrounding tissue. DCIS is sometimes referred to as non-invasive, pre-invasive, or stage zero breast cancer. Most DCIS is first identified with a screening mammogram. DCIS cells typically attract small calcium deposits called calcifications in the breast. These calcifications show up as a group of white, irregular spots on a mammogram. As mammogram technology has become more sensitive, these calcifications have become less difficult to identify. Treatment for DCIS has historically involved surgery, radiation, and endocrine therapy. Around 1 in 4 women with DCIS has a mastectomy, which is surgical removal of all tissue of the affected breast. This treatment may be recommended based on whether DCIS affects a large area or multiple areas of the breast. Most often, a choice of mastectomy is a personal preference, typically for peace of mind. Most women with DCIS opt for breast-conserving surgery, also known as a lumpectomy. This procedure removes the cancer and some of the tissue around it. After the surgery, women often have radiation therapy to reduce the chance that DCIS will recur in that breast or progress to invasive cancer. However, for some women with low-risk DCIS, particularly older women, radiation therapy may not be necessary. Endocrine therapy also may play a role in treatment. With DCIS, 2 out of 3 cancers express an estrogen receptor, or ER, protein. For these cancers, a medication may be used to either block estrogen activity on the cancer cells or reduce the body's ability to generate estrogen. Endocrine therapy lowers the risk of the cancer returning in the affected breast and a new cancer developing in the other breast. For DCIS, Endocrine therapy is typically recommended for 5 years after surgical treatment. Is treatment always necessary? Much uncertainty remains about whether an identified DCIS will progress to invasive cancer. While the current recommendations call for surgical treatment, data show that women with DCIS have a very low long-term risk of dying of breast cancer, just 3%. So a question medical experts continue to explore is whether surgery is necessary for low-risk DCIS. Some experts are looking at the possibility of following an approach called active surveillance. This means that the cancer is regularly monitored with mammograms, but no treatment is started unless the cancer spreads or develops concerning features. That's because data suggests that surgical treatment may not significantly improve survival rates with DCIS, especially with women with low-grade DCIS. Meaning cancer cells that look just a little different from healthy cells are likely to grow slowly. Clinical trials are in progress at Mayo Clinic and other medical centers to further explore the active surveillance option. Shifts have already been made in the last decade to de-escalate treatment of DCIS. Sentinel lymph node removal is no longer standard with surgery, as few women with DCIS have lymph node involvement. Similarly, for some with small, low-grade DCIS, the standard 15 days of whole breast radiation therapy has been replaced with partial breast radiation. This can often be delivered over just a few days with minimal side effects. So work with your care team. As cancer screening techniques have improved, many types of cancer are being diagnosed at an early stage. And as information grows on how people with these early cancers fare over time, it's common for treatment recommendations to change. Work with your care team to choose a treatment path that aligns with your overall health and values. Different treatments continue to be explored for DCIS as medical experts aim to optimize treatments for individual needs. Research also is ongoing to identify genetic indicators called biomarkers that can better predict the likelihood of DCIS progressing to invasive cancer. And here's the health tips column, and there's one article titled Fireworks Safety. Lighting off fireworks can inspire awe and foster patriotic feelings. But as fireworks surge in popularity during the 4th of July period in the U.S., so do fireworks-related injuries. Visits to the emergency room for these injuries have jumped 17% in the last decade, according to one major report. Here are some tips to keep yourself from becoming a fireworks injury statistic. Number one, stay sober. Alcohol and other substances slow reaction time and may impair judgment. This can increase the risk of injuries to yourself and to others when you handle all types of fireworks. Number two, cover your eyes. Eye injuries are very common. Whether you're lighting the fireworks or just observing, consider using protective glasses or goggles. Number three, light right. When lighting a fuse, never hold the firework in your hand or have any part of your body over it. To be safer, use a long-handled lighting device. Number four, stand back. Spectators should stay at least 35 feet away from ground-based fireworks such as fountains. Expand that range to 150 feet for fireworks that go airborne such as bottle rockets. Number five, keep pets and children away. Pets are often terrified of fireworks and should be kept inside. Safety also is critical for children. Mitigate their risk by preserving their ability to enjoy by finding a window they can watch through. Number six, mind the sparklers. Sparklers can be festive and fun, but they burn very hot and often cause injuries. Watch children closely while they're using sparklers and be sure that all users are wearing closed-toed shoes. Have a safe place to discard used sparklers to protect against burns. Number seven, stay grounded. Fireworks that propel upward are most likely to cause injuries. This is in part because they're unpredictable and cover more distance. To prevent injury, stick to ground-based fireworks. You'll see a beautiful display or hear loud booms without the risk of an errant aerial firework veering off. And number eight, keep water nearby. Have a container of water nearby. Submerge used fireworks and disposable lighting devices in the water promptly after use. And moving on now to our next publication, this is the Health and Nutrition Letter from the Tufts University. And that is copyright 2025, Tufts University. This first article is Four Fun Food Facts. What you don't know about the foods you eat may surprise you. Whether you're a curious foodie or just love a good trivia tidbit, these four fun facts will add some flavor to your knowledge and might even inspire a new appreciation for what's on your plate. Number one, there are 7,500 varieties of apples in the world. If you were to eat an apple a day, it would take you over 20 years to try one of each. Which apple you choose depends on what type of flavor and texture you like and whether you plan to use it for snacking, baking, making applesauce, or adding to salads. An apple a day is indeed a healthy choice. Apples are a good source of fiber, vitamins, minerals, and beneficial plant compounds called phytochemicals. They are about 85% water, which makes them a refreshing and hydrating snack. If you don't love apples, the good news is that many other fruits have similar nutrient content. As healthy and delicious as apples are, consuming a variety of fruits and veggies is the best choice. Number two, honey never spoils. The low moisture content and high sugar concentration of honey create an environment where spoilage bacteria cannot grow. Most commercially sold honey is exposed to a mild heat, and that's called pasteurization, to slow down the natural crystallization process. Raw, unprocessed honey is touted as healthier because the heating process may break down pollen and some of the vitamins and other compounds in the honey. However, while honey does contain some potentially beneficial nutrients such as phosphorus, magnesium, potassium, and antioxidant polyphenols and flavanols, the small amount of honey typically consumed provides only trace amounts of these compounds, and we get plenty of these nutrients from other foods in our diets. Pasteurized honey is preferable because raw honey can harbor botulism spores, making it unsafe for infants under 1 year old, who should not eat any type of honey, and individuals with weakened immune systems. Keep in mind that honey is sugar. Like any added sugar, it is not good for your body, and intake should be limited. Number three, peanuts and pistachios aren't actually nuts. Peanuts, otherwise known as ground nuts, belong to the legume family, like beans and lentils, while pistachios are drupes related to peaches and cherries. Despite their botanical classifications, their nutritional makeup is similar to tree nuts. They are rich in unsaturated fats, provide plant sources of protein to replace some animal sources on your plate, and have plenty of fiber. Both pistachios and peanuts are nutritious additions to a balanced diet. Just be careful to avoid added salts and sugars and keep portions to these nutritious but calorie-dense foods small. And number four, in the 1800s, ketchup was marketed as a cure-all. Tomato-based ketchup was believed to treat a variety of ailments, including indigestion, jaundice, and even rheumatism. This was largely due to the perception that tomatoes had powerful medicinal properties. Interestingly, some cultures at one time avoided eating tomatoes because of their botanical relationship to nightshades, which are plants that can be deadly. Cooked tomatoes, whether in ketchup or any type of tomato sauce, are an excellent source of lycopene. And in the laboratory, lycopene was observed to be a potent antioxidant that had been linked to reduced risk of certain cancers. However, these findings have not been adequately corroborated in humans. Modern commercial ketchup is often high in added sugars and sodium, which can contribute to high blood pressure and metabolic disorders if consumed in excess. Consider choosing reduced sugar, reduced sodium varieties. And here's a sidebar to this article. Take charge. Here are some tips that we can learn from these fun food facts. Number one, beware. Even though it's natural, honey is sugar and should be limited. Raw honey can be dangerous for infants and those with compromised immune systems. Number two, apple, blueberry, clementine, all fruits provide fiber, vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, and water. Regularly include a variety as part of your dietary intake. Number three, go nuts. All the foods we call nuts contain heart-healthy fats, fiber, and other beneficial nutrients. Number four, pick plant protein. Animal flesh is the densest source of protein, but plants have protein too, and they're a healthy replacement for meat. And number five, hype is nothing new. Marketers have always made health claims for foods. Check for added sugars, sodium, refined carbohydrates like white flour, and saturated fats before buying. And we have time for a question or two from the that are sent in to the experts, and this is Ask Tufts Experts. So the first question, I am undergoing chemotherapy. I have very little appetite, and sometimes just the smell of food makes me nauseous. How can I get proper nutrition at this important time? And here's the answer. Hannah Wolf, MS, and registered dietitian with a clinical focus on oncology nutrition, answers. Please talk to your healthcare provider about your concerns. It is important to maintain good nutritional status during cancer treatment. Side effects from chemotherapy, such as nausea and taste changes, can make eating a challenge. Dietary advice for people undergoing chemotherapy varies depending on the side effects and individual experiences. Here are some tips my patients have found helpful. Number one, during cancer treatment, your body may need extra calories and protein, as well as health-promoting vitamins and minerals. So incorporate a variety of protein-rich foods such as lean meats, poultry, fish, eggs, legumes, and milk products, whatever is tolerable. Some people find drinking protein-rich smoothies made with plain Greek yogurt, milk, and/or nut butter helpful. Canned liquid supplements are an option as well. They also eat small protein-rich snacks throughout the day, such as Greek yogurt, half a sandwich, or cheese with whole grain crackers. Number two, if you are experiencing nausea, try room temperature or cold food. This limits odors that turn some people off. Ginger can be helpful with nausea. Number three, maintain good hydration. Keep a reusable water bottle by your side. Number four, taste changes are not uncommon in people undergoing chemo. If you have a metallic taste in your mouth, use plasticware instead of metal forks and spoons. Number five, if food tastes bland or off, try adding lemon to food or beverages. Number six, keep your mouth very clean. Make a mouth rinse by adding 1 teaspoon of baking soda and 1 teaspoon of salt to a quart of water. This can neutralize off tastes, and it is beneficial for those suffering from mucositis, which is sore and inflamed mouth, as well. Store it in the refrigerator and use as needed. And number seven, get some movement and exercise. Even though it may feel counterintuitive when you're feeling run down, moving can actually get your energy up, and it helps maintain muscle mass. And one more question. I tend to make less healthful food choices when I'm tired. Is this a real thing, or is it just me? And here's the answer. Jose Ordovas, PhD and leader of the Nutrition and Genomics team at the Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging, answers, you are not alone in noticing a tendency to make less healthful food choices when feeling tired. It is plausible that lack of sleep can affect the food choices and lead to a preference for less nutritional options. Although we do not have enough data to say for sure there is a causal relationship, studies have found that lack of sleep is associated with unhealthy food choices and an increase in overeating. Sleep plays an important role in regulating hunger and appetite-related hormones, such as ghrelin, which is associated with hunger, and leptin, which is responsible for signaling fullness. Lack of sleep has been found to elevate ghrelin levels and decrease leptin levels, leading to increased hunger and appetite. Moreover, it also impacts brain regions that influence your thoughts about food. A study done by University of Chicago researchers found that sleep-deprived participants were unable to resist highly palatable, rewarding snacks like cookies, chips, and candy. Researchers found that sleep restriction boosts a signal that may increase the pleasure and satisfaction gained from eating. However, it is important to note that further research is needed to deepen our understanding of the mechanisms linking inadequate sleep with the increased risk of weight gain. The relationship between sleep and dietary intake may go both ways. A systemic review of studies found that consumption of healthy foods was associated with better sleep quality, while higher intake of processed foods and foods high in added sugars was associated with lower sleep quality. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Leslie with Independent Living. and I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.